This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we spend the hour on a few different topics. Coming up, our environmental reporter Rebecca Thiel unpacks some recent reporting she did on farmers who rent the land that they use and how that relates to whether or not they're likely to adopt sustainable farming practices like no-till and using cover crops. And later, a little fun political theater. An Indiana author shares his new book on political zingers throughout history. But first, a look at Indiana's biggest headlines from the last week with our very own Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not too bad. I'm in the same pants I've been wearing for 4 days, and I think the shirt is even older than that. But, you know, it's radio, so maybe you didn't need to know that. But
you know, I absolutely did, and in a ridiculous turn of events, I'm wearing work clothes today. Like, I don't do that on Fridays when there isn't a global health pandemic, but today, apparently, it's cardigan and button down.
It's a mood thing. I'm sure you look wonderful. You often do. And I miss sitting across the desk from you, but for now, this is going to have to do. Let's get an update on the numbers that came through just an hour ago.
Yeah. So the numbers, which are updated to the State Health Department at 11:59 p.m., and then they update it 12 hours later on their website. We have more than 10,000 confirmed cases in the state, and we passed a threshold today with 519 deaths, but with more than 54,000 people having been tested. To kind of compare it to last week, we had nearly 7,000 confirmed cases, 300 deaths, and more than 35,000 tests done. So it's a bit of an ugly threshold to be at.
Indeed. And I mean, 300 deaths at this time last week, 200 more within the last 24 hours. That is indeed an ugly threshold. So what did the state health commissioner say?
Yeah. So this week, we actually, this is weirdly enough, still kind of a bit of good news. State Health Commissioner Chris Box expected this to be much worse. The earlier projections had our peak being a little bit earlier in the year, earlier in April. And so she shared with reporters that the state is seeing positive trends, that we are actually flattening the curve quite a bit. The latest projections say the surge will hit Indianapolis in late April and the rest of the state in early May. So the stay-at-home order and social distance measures that have been in place since about March 6th are working. The one worry is if we pull back on social distancing measures too soon, but Governor Eric Holcomb says he's not planning on doing that. In fact, he characterized any sort of relaxing on stay-at-home orders being a rolling reopen and said that it wouldn't be like turning on a light switch.
Okay, gotcha. And so this peak that we've talked about, again, you just said that it's looking like it won't come until the end of the month. Mm-hmm. I recall not that long ago that they thought it would be somewhere in the middle of this past week. Now they've kind of revised that?
Yeah, so what happens when with all of the projections and the concept of flattening the curve, when you flatten the curve, you're also pushing back the surge, the peak of everything. And so the reason that we do that and the reason why it's a good thing is not only one for the prevention of loss of life, it decreases the number of people that die, even as it extends the length of the overall pandemic. But it also, because it extends that length, it gives hospitals time to be able to react to everything. It doesn't put nearly as much of a stress on those supplies and resources and just human hours as well.
So let's get into what the governor said about reopening the economy.
Yeah. So he indicated that there will have to be new workplace accommodations made to ensure employee safety before businesses reopen. And he didn't actually elaborate what those accommodations would look like. But he says that, yeah, we're kind of getting ready to reopen certain sections of the economy. Whatever you're imagining for what business as usual might look like may actually be considerably different than you'd expect. But those tweaks are likely to happen as he extends the stay-at-home order, which is currently set to expire on Monday. And that rolling reopen is going to be a regional reopen. Holcomb on Thursday joined a bipartisan group of states, including Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, to coordinate reopening businesses and their economies. There are a few ways that can look like, but in Holcomb's statement, he referenced phasing in sectors of the economy.
Okay. Well, speaking of the economy, there have been a few announcements with our state's unemployment insurance system. What's going on? When are the gig economy and self-employed people going to get their checks?
Yeah. So good news first. The state... good gracious. The Department of Workforce Development has a very rough timeline for connecting self-employed, independent contractors, and gig economy Hoosiers to unemployment benefits. So there's a huge caveat to this entire timeline, which is you're asking the state to rebuild an unemployment system. And so this is all heavily reliant on tech people being able to hit deadlines and the technology working for it. The targets are April 24th, which is a week from today, for the system to start accepting applications, and then May 4th for payments to start rolling out. A lot of things have to go perfectly right for that to happen, but those are the targets from DWD. And then the other news is while the federal government provided a 13-week extension to unemployment benefits through the CARES Act, it will be several weeks before Hoosiers who have already exhausted the state's 26-week cap since last July can actually access that. Indiana has a cap, and while that federal extension is out there, again, it is one of those things where DWD has to be able to put those extensions into the system that they have set up. They wanted to prioritize self-employed Hoosiers and contractors, gig economy workers, et cetera, before they tried to tackle that particular problem as well.
And I know there's been some criticism as to, you know, how this has been handled, but they're literally having to rebuild software and the entire computer system, as you said. Mm-hmm. And so this is a process that is going to take some time, but they seem to be rushing through it as best they can.
Yeah, they're it is a global health pandemic, so we're all just trying to kind of make it work. And DWD is absolutely doing that as well. Yeah, we'll see what happens, especially with trying to figure out rebuilding software on the fly for millions of people and their financial information. That is a hefty task to undertake.
Along those lines, I know you're not unemployed, and thank goodness for that. But did you get your stimulus money this week, Lauren?
Oh, maybe I did, maybe I didn't.
I haven't really had time to look. You're a busy person.
I can neither confirm nor deny whether or not I got a $1,200 check.
Yeah, 10-4. All right. Well, with all of these changes, there were also a few announcements made by the about the election this week.
Yes. So the slightly wonkier thing first, because I love it because of its wonkiness. Earlier this week, Indiana Democrats announced they will hold their 2020 state convention online amid growing concerns about the impact of COVID-19. Democrats choose their nominees for lieutenant governor and attorney general at this year's convention. So we don't vote for those two particular positions in primaries. And there are a handful of other executive branch positions that we don't do that on the years that they are up for election. The convention also elects the state's delegates to the Democratic National Convention. So those votes will happen as a mail-in ballot, and then they will host the convention online.
But we've already extended vote by mail to Hoosiers in some way, right? What are the details on that?
Yeah, so the state has already extended vote by mail. Before the pandemic, the requirements for voting by mail were some of the most restrictive in the country. But yesterday, Secretary of State Connie Lawson announced Indiana is going to limit in-person voting to just 1 week leading up to and including Election Day on June 2nd. Normally, in-person voting lasts about a month before the election. She also announced that the state will also make a push, particularly on social media, to recruit more poll workers and especially young people. At the very, very beginning of all of this, the state announced initially that they were going to push back the primary. Lawson and the governor sounded a little bit more hesitant about using vote by mail as the primary method, that they were concerned that it would overwhelm county offices and things along those lines. And this more recent information from them makes it sound like they are a little bit more gung-ho about making sure that everybody stays away from one another and really pushing vote by mail.
Okay. And yeah, we have to register to vote by May 4th. Mm-hmm. To vote by mail, we request a ballot by May 21st. Mm-hmm. Are we still using the Indiana 2022 way to cover COVID-19?
Oh, my goodness, yes. every single story that we send out on web has an embed. So for folks who have questions that they didn't feel got answered within the story or something that they have been looking for and haven't been able to find, if you drop your email address in that box along with your question, we will respond to you. We will find the answers for you. And if you want to have even more communication than that, you can join our texting tool, which all you have to do is text elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 way. Of course, we are covering COVID-19, but we're also going to cover the impacts that it has not only on the health and business aspects of this state, but the reverberations that maybe even hit the ballot box.
All right. In other news, Lauren, how are you holding up? Are you working normal hours?
Yeah, sure. Those are normal.
Sure. Well, what are you doing at home when you're not working?
When I'm not working? it's mostly been my favorite wine is Apothic, and I accidentally picked up their Cabernet. And so I had a glass of that last night. The mostly Apothic and.
So we're only talking about the wine we're drinking. I totally, totally get it. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and she joins us every Friday at about this time. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports on a Purdue study that shows farmers who rent are less likely to adopt more sustainable farming practices. We'll talk about why that is and what could improve things. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There's a lot of farmland in Indiana, but almost half of it isn't owned by the farmer who uses it. So when a farmer or landowner wants to implement more sustainable farming practices, they need permission from the other. This ends up meaning that farmers who rent are less likely to do things like no-till farming or cover crops. Indiana Public Broadcasting environmental reporter Rebecca Thiel has been reporting on this, and she joins us now. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Matt.
So let's start with some background. There are a number of different conservation practices farmers can implement to improve soil, water quality, and so forth. But they're, of course, optional. Let's talk about the two that you focus on for your report. First of all, cover crops. What are they and what do they do?
So it's basically what it sounds like. It's a cover crop is a crop that is covering the land. And basically, you know, those roots from cover crops help to hold the soil in place. So, you know, in the winter, you might often see these big brown fields that have been tilled. Well, you know, sometimes when a big rain comes through, that soil is actually going to wash away. And, you know, that's not only washing away pollutants or sediment pollutants into waterways, but that's also washing away good soil.
Ah, okay. So cover crops then, I guess, act like grass in a person's lawn. They help to...
You know, they lessen the erosion. A lawn is a really good example. If you look out at your lawn and you see some, you know, dry, bare patches, that's likely going to be the thing that gets disturbed when heavy rain comes through.
So cover crops, I mean, are they crops that can then be harvested and sold in the way that, you know, a summer crop would do?
Generally, no. This is really something that you are doing for the soil, for the water quality, and to just kind of make sure that your investment is in place. Often, if you till with cover crops, that those nutrients are then going to go back into the soil. So they kind of stay put.
So what are the drawbacks then of using cover crops?
So, you know, a lot of farmers, I think, would say is it takes a while for them to get established. And then, you know, like any other sort of different crop that you might do, seed has a cost. So those are kind of some of the things why, you know, that might be something to consider on the farm.
Okay. And it sounds like they would be just as much work, perhaps maybe not just as much, but a good amount of work. I mean, you are talking about planting an entire field not once, but twice a year. Is that part of the issue as well?
Well, I'm sure. Yeah.
About no-till. I mean, that sounds pretty self-explanatory. No tilling before the next season's planting. What's the benefit of no-till?
So there are a lot of the same kinds of benefits of cover crops, you know, kind of holding that soil in place because, you know, if you're not tilling the soil, you're not disturbing those roots. You know, you might save money on fertilizer, for example, because, again, kind of the nutrients from those crops are staying in the soil. You're not kind of disturbing them and tilling them up. And then no-till farming, of course, you kind of mentioned that, you know, it's not tilling for the most part. So that lowers some of your labor costs as well. And, you know, maybe you don't have to drive that tractor through the field that time of year. So you're not spending as much money on fuel.
And it sounds to me like it's actually less work as well. Why wouldn't more farmers want to do no-till?
Well, there are some things that you do need to have generally with no-till. You may want to buy certain kinds of equipment for this. For instance, you know, you may be thinking, well, if I have a no-till farm, how is it that I get seeds in the ground? Well, you'd have to maybe buy something called a seed drill, which actually pokes holes in the land so those seeds can be deposited.
Okay, so it's an equipment cost then. So before, I guess, we can understand how these practices help, we need to know what kind of an impact traditional agriculture has on things like soil and water quality. What do we know about that?
Well, starting with soil, just like when you're building a house, there are a lot of house comparisons that I make in this story, and I think that it rings true. Just like when you're building a house, you know, those trucks that construction workers have, they drive them right up to the site, and that compacts the soil. Well, the same thing is going to happen when you're running a tractor over farmland. So, you know, that's not something completely natural. It's not good for the soil. So that's kind of more on the farmer's side of things. But, you know, it can have long-term impacts. Sometimes it can take a while for soil that has been, you know, conventionally farmed to get back to what it naturally used to be many, many years ago. So, and water quality, that's really the big issue here. When that soil runs off into streams, lakes, rivers, it can have hugely harmful effects, not only to wildlife, to, you know, the fish and other aquatic life in that stream, but, you know, I'm sure that a lot of people have heard about the algal blooms in the Toledo, Ohio area, and that really threatening drinking water. You know, that's kind of where that comes from, too, that sort of sediment pollution and fertilizer pollution. Those are the kinds of things that can happen.
I've also heard a lot about the impact that farming has on climate change. How much of a factor is it?
So it's huge. Actually, I have some data from EPA here, and the total greenhouse gas emissions used by agriculture alone in the U.S. is 10%. 10% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Now, keep in mind, that is not nearly as high as something like transportation. That's 28%. But, you know, that's a big chunk. And on the other hand, of course, farmers can trap carbon, you know, by using practices like no-till and other, you know, plants trap carbon. So, you know, much like when we talk about forests kind of helping with climate change by trapping that CO2, you know, farms or fields can also do the same thing.
So it sounds to me like both no-till and cover crops can help to trap carbon. Do the two go hand in hand? I mean, can a farmer use both at the same time, and do they often?
Yeah, they can definitely go hand in hand. You know, they don't always happen together, but I would say definitely on a no-till farm, I've been told that you do want to have cover crops, because no-till, you know, still you may be going over the land with that big tractor, you know, or seed drill or what have you, and that will compact the soil. So cover crops, those roots help to break up that soil where maybe tilling would have done the same thing before.
In your story, you focus on this study out of Purdue. What is it and what does it say?
Well, basically what they did is they interviewed a bunch of farmers and what we call non-operating landowners. So that's really the kinds of landowners we're talking about here. They are landowners who own the farm, but they don't work it. And basically, they talked about all of these different barriers for farmers and landowners who want to adopt conservation practices. And, you know, a lot of it seems to be about this connection between farmer and landowner.
We're talking to our Indiana Public Broadcasting environmental reporter, Rebecca Thiel, about farmers and landowners and implementing sustainable farming practices and the barriers therein. And so what do these land leases that we're talking about look like? Are they like the kind of lease that we might take out on an apartment? And as in, are they annual, I guess?
Often I've been told they are, just like we would have with an apartment or something like that. And, you know, the funny thing is that these leases, even though they are every year, you know, oftentimes these are renewed for several years, sometimes decades. But, you know, that annual lease puts a little bit of pressure on farmers. You know, they don't really know whether or not they're going to have that land to rent next year.
And it also sounds like these conservation practices can take a few seasons to really show their benefits. Does it seem like that factors into farmers' reluctance to adopt them?
Absolutely. You know, I think I might have used this example in the story, but, you know, I personally rent. I'm very hesitant to make a whole lot of improvements upon the house that I rent if, you know, maybe I'm not going to be there next year. Or I won't see the benefits of what I've done. And, you know, most likely I'll sink some money into it too.
And farmers will as well, of course. So what other than just the responsibility aspect of it would make a farmer want to implement these practices?
You know, a lot of the farmers that I talk to who do these practices say it's really, you know, it's about a passion for that kind of farming. They like the stewardship of it, the stewardship of the land, you know, maintaining that water quality, that soil quality. But of course, there are benefits for farmers. You know, we talked about a lot of the benefits of cover crops and no-till. You know, some say that actually it, you know, cover crops, for instance, could lead to higher yields. Some say that it can reduce weeds, helps the soil stay moist, you know, so there's not as much watering and using water, you know, so there are all kinds of reasons why they would, but, you know, there's many barriers as well.
And isn't farming, I mean, can it be kind of competitive? Is that an issue here too?
In terms of rent? Absolutely. So, you know, we could go into a lot of different discussions about how farming has changed over time, but basically there are more farmers willing to rent land than there really is land to rent. So, you know, if you're a farmer, you want to make sure that you're making your landlord happy, because you don't want them to say, you know, I think I'll find someone else.
So the landowner just, in many cases, just owns the land, and the farmer is the one actually using it. How much of this issue has to do with whether or not the landowner knows enough about things like cover crops and no-till?
Well, yeah, it's a huge part of it because, you know, if you're a landowner, and I guess there are many different types of landowners that I've heard about in going through this story, you know, one might be the landowner who farmed before, and they have a certain way of farming. And, you know, maybe they're just interested in doing the way that they did it before because it worked for them. And, you know, in many ways, there's nothing wrong with that. Then there's the landowner who, you know, and increasingly this is the kind of landowner that we're seeing is a landowner who has never farmed before and has maybe inherited the land. And, you know, perhaps they're just not educated about farming in general. So, you know, of course, you're not going to go and advocate for a kind of practice if you don't really know anything about it.
So far in this conversation, I've been picturing the farmers being the one who want to implement these practices. I haven't given much thought to whether the landowners do or not, although it factors in. Obviously, that's what we're talking about. How much of it goes the other way? Are there just as many landowners who want the farmers who farm their land to adopt these practices?
I can't necessarily say how many there are because, you know, that's a whole other issue of finding that data. But there definitely are landowners who want to implement these practices. But, you know, it's that can have its own barriers, trying to have that conversation with your farmer when, you know, maybe if you've never farmed before, how do you feel like you have the authority to kind of start that discussion?
But isn't the landowner kind of the boss in these scenarios? Don't they have most of the power?
I think that's arguably true. And I think that it's sometimes there is a misunderstanding. Sometimes landowners don't really know quite what the market is like. You know, basically, you have these landowners who do hold the power, but they may not know that there is this competitive market where the landowner is really the one holding the cards. So they may be just as afraid of losing their farmer, thinking, will I ever get another farmer again?
Is age a factor here? It seems like in so many scenarios like this, and it goes far beyond farming, a lot of older folks tend to be skeptical about non-traditional practices, which is kind of what we're talking about here. No-till and cover crops aren't exactly the norm. Is that part of the issue?
According to Purdue University, there are landowners do tend to scale older than their farmers. Certainly, there are plenty of older landowners who are interested in things like no-till and cover crops. But, you know, it's hard not to see a bit of a connection there.
What else can cause this breakdown of communication?
So one thing that I think is really interesting is that we're actually seeing more female landowners as well, and more female, as I said, non-operating landowners. So women who may have inherited the land, whether that's from their father or their other relatives, and maybe just have never farmed themselves and are kind of just being thrown into this situation. And, you know, as I said before, with landowners who haven't farmed, maybe being a little bit nervous about telling their farmer what to do because their farmer, after all, is, you know, in their minds, the expert. You know, this can also happen when you have a female landowner and a male farmer, where, you know, a little bit of gender roles come into play. And, you know, perhaps the female landowner may not feel like she can tell her male farmer what kinds of practices she would like to see on her land. So, you know, there can be a bit of tension there as well.
You talked to the group Women for the Land for your story. What are they doing about this?
So they are holding women's circles where basically female landowners can come together and talk about what's happening on the farm, talk about the kinds of things that they would like to see on their land, the kinds of things that they've tried and maybe haven't worked, or they've tried and it's worked spectacularly. So, you know, being there, it was really interesting to see how much advice everyone was giving. And it seems like it does sort of foster a kind of different environment than perhaps if you were to go to any other sort of educational seminar or what have you, or workshop about how to do some of these practices.
Other than the environmental benefits, and there are many, are there other incentives to farmers or landowners to doing this, adopting these practices?
Sure. The state and federal government have financial incentives for some of these practices, and even practices that we haven't even listed. Now, granted, you know, especially with cover crops, I've been told that it's really not going to cover everything, but it might help them get started. It might help, you know, maybe bridge that gap between a farmer who really wants to do this practice and maybe a landowner who just doesn't seem as keen.
All right. Rebecca Thiel covers environmental issues for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Rebecca, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for your show, Matt.
Up next, some politicians really have a quick wit and a sharp tongue. That combination and its influence throughout history has fascinated Indiana author Chris Lamb for years. He shares his new book, The Art of the Political Putdown, next. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It used to be that we needed distractions from politics, but now politics are the distraction from, well, everything else. If you're looking for some fun reading to pass the time, the new book, The Art of the Political Putdown, is out now, and one of its authors is IUPUI journalism professor Chris Lamb. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Matt. Thanks.
So this is a book about all the political comebacks from history. We're not just talking about the United States here, though, right?
Oh, sure. It goes all the way back, 5,000 years B.C. to the Greeks and the Romans. And the only difference is that, you know, back then they didn't have the respect for us to tape it on YouTube. So it's...
Well, there are some real zingers in this book. How long have you been interested in political comebacks?
Well, I began looking at political comebacks when I went to college about 40 years ago. And I was such a rube. I went to school and somebody had a Playboy magazine at it. And I was I thought you were supposed to read it. And there was an article in it about the best putdowns comebacks of all time. And I read the article and I've been saving these comebacks ever since.
Can you point to maybe a specific comeback that you would say started it all?
Oh, yeah, I can, actually. There's the one, a British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, who's sort of the star of the book. He'd been drinking heavily at a party when he bumped into Bessie Braddock, who's a member of Parliament. And she's this old matronly lady, and she looks at him and she says, "Mr. Churchill, you're drunk." And Churchill pauses and says, "And Betsy, you are ugly. You are very ugly. I'll be sober in the morning."
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yeah.
There are so many other examples from Winston Churchill. As you say, he's kind of the star of the book. What was it about him?
You know, I think the difference between him and other people is that he used comebacks as a sword. You know, there's a mean spiritedness to Winston Churchill. He wanted to leave his opponent red-faced and stammering and left to pick up the pieces of their manhood and put it in a thimble and skulk off in silence. You know, he just wanted to. It was a sport with him. There's a time when he and an American politician in Great Britain, and they're sort of shouting back and forth at each other. Lady Astor says, "Mr. Churchill, if you were my husband, I'd put poison in your coffee." And Churchill says, "If I were your husband, I'd drink it."
Oh, my gosh. But, I mean, was that just him, or was that calculated? Was that, I don't know, was that effective for him?
It was effective for him. That's a really good question. I'm not sure it's effective for other people.
Okay. All right.
And this was sort of the way you played ball in Parliament. In America, I don't think that works as well. I think you have to be a little bit more deft. And the best American politicians who do this were Abraham Lincoln while Churchill would use a sword, he would use a shield, and he'd use his shield to sort of and his wit to sort of bounce off a comeback. And he was very self-deprecating. One time he was debating Stephen Douglas in the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates, and Douglas said he called Lincoln two-faced. And when it was Lincoln's time to speak, he says, "I leave it to my audience. If I had another face, would I wear this one?" And so that way, you know, with Churchill, you offend people. You know, with Lincoln, you become sympathetic.
How long have you been thinking about doing a whole book about this?
Oh, a long time. You know, some people collect jewelry and paintings and I collect these things. It's kind of a sad statement of my life and my hobbies. So it takes a while, and you get 1,000 or two, and you cut them down to about 350, and then the book. My co-writer and I, Will Murdoch, wrote a lot of essays because we wanted a book instead of the book being a bathroom book, which these kind of books are. We wanted this to be sort of upgraded to a book you might read before dozing off at night.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your collaboration with your co-author, the late Will Murdoch. Who was he?
Oh, Will was my publisher. He was this great guy who lived. I knew when I was in Charleston, and he wrote a column for the Weekly Entertainment. And he was always taking on issues, and he was a publisher on the side, and he did a book we did called "I'll Be Sober in the Morning," which was a much smaller version of the book that's out right now. And we became good friends, and he was just such a wit, and he was also great for me because I can tend to, you know, I like the comebacks that are a little hard, and Will was kind of reminding me that all the people who would read this book were not drunk at the time. So he sort of was able to tone the book back a little bit so it was more acceptable for a larger audience.
I understand he passed away before the book was finished.
Yeah, we were finished with our work on it, and something to use just 68 or 9 years old, and just something came up a year ago. And it was just a very sad thing. He was a good friend and such a wit, and I miss him. But I was, you know, it was nice that at least we got the book and I was able to dedicate it. And he's, you know, he's out there laughing with me.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, but I'm thankful that you pressed on, and now we have this really comprehensive and entertaining book. I'll play some examples from more modern times in a little bit. But this sort of thing has been going on since long before recording technology has existed. Of course, you say that the book goes back, in some cases, thousands of years. What are some?
Oh, this is thousands of years in the making, yeah.
What are some of the better examples from history that we don't have audio of?
There's this one where John Wilkes, who was an 18th century political reformer, and he's involved in this angry exchange with John Montague, the fourth Earl of Sandwich, in Parliament. And Montague yells at Wilkes, "Sir, I do not know whether you will die on the gallows or of the pox." Whereupon Wilkes responds, "That, sir, depends on whether I embrace your principles or your mistress."
Goodness gracious.
And the great thing about this is that it had to be ad-libbed. You know, Winston Churchill once says, you know, the best comebacks, the best responses are thought of a week or two in advance. In this case, it had to be an ad lib.
Well, I'm going to play some audio, and I'm going to go in a sort of semi-chronological order here. I have some clips of exactly what we're talking about. Of course, all of these are examples that are in the book with context surrounding them. And it's really, really beautifully written. It's a lot of fun. It just washes over you. Let's start with how Ronald Reagan responded to this question in 1984.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Oh, I mean, but Reagan was, he was no stranger to the spotlight. He knew how to communicate on the fly. But just as you said before we played the clip, this was one of those remarks that was more or less prepared, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's where Reagan was at his best. But Reagan had, you know, probably the best sense of humors of the presidents were Lincoln and Obama and Reagan. And Reagan had a show business background. He had this wonderful sense of humor and his kindly sense of humor. His sense of humor was never mean-spirited. And what this line does, if you watch the tape, you see Walter Mondale smiling. And Walter Mondale later says, if you look closely, I'm crying because I know the election is over and Reagan's going to get reelected.
Oh, my goodness.
Because the issue of Reagan's age just went away in 5 seconds. And that's what happens with humor. And that's what happens with someone like a Reagan who can deliver this line, making it seem spontaneous when it's not. But he's able to use his wit as a way to become endearing and as a way to, you know, pretty much kill the other person's argument.
All right. This one now comes up every 4 years before the vice presidential debates. It's regarded as one of the harshest comebacks in modern history. Here is Michael Dukakis's VP candidate, Lloyd Benson, and George H.W. Bush's then VP candidate and Hoosier, though we're not proud of him at this moment, Dan Quayle. And he speaks first.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
That was really uncalled for, Senator.
You're the one that was making the comparison, Senator.
Chris, as effective as it was in the moment, George H.W. Bush, of course, won the election and Dan Quayle became the vice president. But how long did that comment follow him around?
Oh, now?
up to this point,
you know, that's basically, you know, he was reduced from a politician to a punchline at that point, and he never recovered. He will never recover from it. And the problem with this is, if you're in politics and you're getting ready for an important debate, you can't keep using the same lines that you use when you're out campaigning. And that's what Quayle was doing, because your opponents are watching it like a football team is scouting their opponents. And Quayle's advisor said, do not use the JFK comparison. Do not use the JFK comparison. Quayle being Quayle, used the JFK comparison, and Benson was waiting for him. And, you know, politics is a dog-eat-dog world, and Dan Quayle became the fire hydrant.
At that time, I was so young, I had no idea, you know, what the campaign verbiage was at the time. I did not realize that he was saying that. So Lloyd Benson was ready for that comment. It seems so off the cuff.
Yes. And this happens a lot. I mean, Ronald Reagan is shrewd enough. Ronald Reagan knows this question is coming. And I think that that's the thing that's so lacking in politics is a sense of humor. That's why I love this book. Is because a lot of people are interested. I'm interested in sharp-witted politicians because there are so few of them.
There was a debate among the Democratic candidates for president in late 2007. This one took place in Iowa, and this exchange was between who would become the two frontrunners for the nomination, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. The moderator speaks first.
Senator Obama, you have Bill Clinton's former national security advisor, State Department Policy Director and Navy Secretary, among others, advising you. With relatively little foreign policy experience of your own, how will you rely on so many Clinton advisors and still deliver the kind of break from the past that you're promising voters?
Well, I am...
I want to hear that.
Do I hear that? Well, Hillary, I'm looking forward to you advising me as well.
Chris, this one was actually prophetic. Hillary Clinton did end up advising him on foreign policy.
And it wasn't ad lib. And the thing about Obama is he has these qualities that are really rare in politicians. He has a good ear, a nimble brain, a sharp wit, and a comics timing. And Hillary Clinton has this self-satisfied laugh after she chimes in. And what happens exactly? It's prophetic. But what Obama did in this moment, probably about a month before the Iowa caucus on TV, is he proved that he demonstrated that he belonged up there. Because he had this great line, and everybody cheered him, and suddenly we realized that this was that people saw a quality in Obama that's fairly rare in politics. And it was exactly right. You're absolutely right. But Obama then wins the debate. He wins the caucuses. He wins the nomination. He serves two terms as president, and Hillary Clinton ends up advising him.
Okay, let's hear a moment that many say gave us Donald Trump, the candidate, and now the president. This was from 2011, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which used to be a really fun event that the president would always attend and would give a speech, usually a humorous one with a few shots taken at critics, all in good fun. Of course, Donald Trump has skipped all three that have been held during his presidency. It was this comment from then-President Barack Obama that some have said made Donald Trump decide to run for president. Here we go.
No, seriously, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice, at the steakhouse, the men's cooking team did not impress the judges from Omaha Steaks. And there was a lot of blame to go around, but you, Mr. Trump, recognized that the real problem was a lack of leadership. And so ultimately, you didn't blame Little John or Meatloaf. You fired Gary Busey. And these are the kind of decisions that would keep me up at night.
Chris, who has confirmed that this was the moment that made Donald Trump decide to run?
Roger Stone, who is one of Trump's top advisors, was sitting there. And what happened during this 3-minute takedown that Obama delivers is you look at Trump and people who are watching Trump while this is going on, Trump is not smiling. He is, unlike most of this, when most people are roasted, you know, the politicians always kind of laugh along. Oh, you got me this time. He is just standing there and he's absolutely mortified. And when he gets done, he wants to get the last laugh and the last word. And apparently he did.
There are plenty of examples in your book of clever comebacks that really made a positive difference in someone's political career. And then there are those that simply did not for one reason or another. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, which has really taken up a lot of the attention nowadays, we were used to hearing public insults on an almost daily basis in the political arena. I'm curious what you think of that. When political insults become as common as they are now, are they still just as effective depending on the audience?
Yeah, I think they are. I think the good ones are. I think what happens when they're prepared, I call those zingers. I don't call them comebacks if they're prepared. But I still think there are politicians out there who are quite funny. And among the Democratic candidates, of which I didn't get very many chuckles during the Democratic debates, because it's all these debates are not spontaneous. Everybody's got their canned line. But, you know, Amy Klobuchar was probably the funniest of the Democratic candidates, which I realize is to damn with faint praise. It's like calling Mo the smartest of the Three Stooges. You know, but there's a line that I like that's in the book with her. And in 2018, Tammy Duckworth of Illinois became the first U.S. senator to give birth while serving in office, only to discover there's a rule that says you can't bring babies on the Senate floor. And she asked Senator Klobuchar for advice on the rule. And when Utah Senator Orrin Hatch learned of this, he asked, what would happen if there are 10 babies on the floor of the Senate? And Klobuchar answered, we already have 10 babies on the floor of the Senate.
Chris Lamb is co-author of the new book, The Art of the Political Putdown. It's out now. Chris, thank you so much for the book, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Matt. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Catch up on our podcast wherever you get podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. On Monday, we'll talk about how kids with special needs are getting through this tough situation and what can be done to make it easier. I'm Matt Pelser. Have a great weekend. This is All In.